this is just not right. I mean, the weather. I mean, yes, it's nice out there and a little windy. But no. It's not supposed to be this nice until at least April the 16th. You know, come on. What are y'all thinking about out there? But it is nice. You know, last weekend we were at Seawee and out at the beach Sunday. It was like 74 degrees. No biggie. And you could be out at the beach today. I think my daughter was going yesterday afternoon. That's perks of going to college near the coast. Well, welcome to Woods and Water, South Carolina. My name is Roger Metz, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Yes, we were at Seawee last weekend. Another great time. I hope the people that got the free tickets enjoyed it. I ought to start requiring them to like send pictures or call in afterwards or something to let me know. But I did get a message from one guy that got a couple 3-day tickets, and they were there. Didn't get to see them, but it was a lot of people. Yeah, perfect weather for the weekend. We posted a notice this morning, said it was the largest crowd they'd ever had, and I believed it. There was it was shoulder to shoulder most places you went, but it was really nice. Everybody was courteous. Lots of dogs around. Got to spend a good bit of time watching the dock dogs out of Brittle Bank Park this year. And then went and looked at a lot of wildlife art, sculpture, which is, you know, it's not necessarily my thing, but there's an appreciation there. We actually met Friday night. We went to Flood Tide Company, had a little open house oyster roast, and the first hull from, I forget the boat manufacturer's name now, local company, first flats boat they delivered to Doug Rowland over at Flood Tide Company, and met one of the artists was there. See, Paul Puckett's a big artist. If you don't know, he does some good stuff. But a friend of his was there. We met him, and as we were going through the art exhibit, he was painting right there in the, you know, while everybody else was displaying, he was actually doing a painting. It was really cool. We got to talk to him, watch him paint a little bit. And so there's an appreciation there. If it's not your thing, so to speak, you know, wildlife art, man, it's, and you can tell the really good ones. Wow, man. Went by one guy from, I believe, Georgia. He had a quail painting. And I just stood there looking at it, and he goes, "You've been there, haven't you?" I said, "Yep." And the picture had an old chimney. And growing up, we had a tenant house, like a sharecropper house on the farm that we burned down, and the chimney was still there. And there was always a covey of quail around that chimney. And so he said, "I like to paint things that are familiar with people." It really sucks them in, and it did. It was just great. But anyway, good time at Seawee. If you didn't get down there this year, hope you make plans to be down there next year. Man, what an event to have here right here in South Carolina. Well, with the weather outside like it is, have you been out there? Have you gone hiking? If you have, congratulations. If you haven't, what's your excuse? There's no excuse not to be out and enjoy. In fact, there's probably two people listening today. Three, maybe. My mom, my wife, and maybe one of my daughters is listening. Anybody else, you're a bonus. Appreciate it. But if you're not outside today, man, what a day to be outside. Real quick, the Bassmaster tournament on Lake Okeechobee is going on. And, wow, Andy Montgomery from Blacksburg, South Carolina, is in fifth place. Has 5 fish for 25 pounds today. That's an average of 5 pounds a piece. That's incredible. But they're pulling some 8-9 pound fish out of Lake Okeechobee right now. Jason Williamson from down in the Lowcountry is in 13th. He's got 5 for 15. And Casey, where'd he go? Oh, 32nd right now. They all made the top 50 cut to fish today. Tomorrow's cut's the top 12. So Casey's got 46 pounds total. And the cut right now is about 53, so he's got to have a couple of big ones. It doesn't look like he's got anything really big today, 5 for 14. So anyway, it's really fun to watch. You know, they're in Lake Okeechobee. It's nothing but a big grass bed, essentially. And, man, seeing those guys out there work those, I mean, some guys are flipping all day long. You're right, Shoulder. I mean, casting's one thing. Flipping's a totally different technique. It's got to be tough on them. Let's see, what else we got? 5 minutes to do a calendar. Let's just keep burning some time here. We're going to talk to Woodrow Ross, I believe, after the break. He's doing a class out at Cabela's coming up sometime in March. So we're going to talk to him a little bit. Let's see. What else we got? We got the weather. Get that. We got seaweed. Yeah. Okay. Oh, here you go. Besides the weather outside, everything is blooming. You know, there's actually pollen out there. You know it's really bad when the briars have little leaves on them already. I got chewed up the other day, and I looked down. I was bleeding, and little leaves on the briar. I mean, it's just February. Not supposed to happen yet. Really cool. If you don't know who OSearch is, OSearch, and I got it pulled up here. Let's see what it is. OSearch, you know, they're kind of a international shark tagging research organization. Well, shark tagging expedition heads to the low country. This was a DNR release on February 23rd. Like birds that fly south, many sharks migrate to warmer waters for the winter. And in South Carolina, animal tracking data have shown those winter visitors often include white shark. If you don't remember, sometime back in back a few years ago, they tagged a shark named Mary Lee. And, you know, when the sharks come to the surface, they have GPS trackers and pingers, and it pings, and they pretty much locate the shark, kind of know when it's where it is and where it's headed, where it's been, because you can go back and look at tracking data essentially since the first day they were tagged. And Mary Lee actually pinged above the 526 bridge in Charleston. Now, those things are accurate within a few miles, so, you know, could have been outside the jetties, most likely inside the jetties from what I understand. But anyway, so they go all over the world tagging sharks, whether it's white sharks, tiger sharks, mako sharks, whatever. Now shark tagging nonprofit OSearch is heading to South Carolina and its neighboring states to learn more about these important ocean predators, also known as great white sharks. Expedition Lowcountry will last 3 weeks, during which time a multi-institutional team of scientists aboard the research vessel OSearch hopes to tag, sample, and release mature white sharks. DNR's marine biologist Brian Frazier will serve as chief scientist on the expedition, helping coordinate the dozen-plus research projects. The expedition samples will benefit, including studies of the white shark vision, reproduction, movement, and parasites. Due to relatively rare nature of these sharks and the difficulty associated with capturing and getting samples, we hope to maximize the amount of research possible for each animal, said Frazier. We've always known white sharks occurred off of South Carolina during winter months, but tracking sharks like the Lowcountry favorite Mary Lee has changed the way we perceive white sharks, with tracking data suggesting they may prefer coastal waters to open ocean. With each additional shark we tag, we gain tremendous insight in their movements and patterns. Frazier is going to be joined by 9 other researchers, including the Moat Marine Laboratory, Woods Hole, Oceanographic Institute, and the University of North Florida, College of Charleston past Professor Gavin Naylor, and University of South Carolina Beaufort Associate Professor Kim Ritchie are also members of the science team who will be there getting all this. DNR does not have an active white shark tagging program, and animals tagged by their researchers are frequently documented in South Carolina waters. In recent years, 36 individual tagged white sharks have been detected by DNR acoustic arrays, an extensive system of underwater receivers that record pings. But anyway, I've said all of that, which is, you know, okay, so what are you trying to get at? Well, I'm actually going off with OSearch. I got an invitation from them to go off for the day. They'll pick me up at a dock, take me out. I'll be on the boat all day. You know, normally with me, the fishing is better the day before I got there, the day after. Maybe fishing will be better the day I'm there. But it's going to be pretty cool. It will be a hands-on. I won't get down on the platform with the great shark, great white, I don't expect. But it's going to be a great one, so... As far as information for this show going forward, man, that's going to be it's just information. It's good you know this stuff. So anyway, I'm going to have a ball doing that. And, of course, I'll bring back a lot of good stuff for you. Yes, and I'll hang on through the break. Be back on the other side with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. What an appropriate song. Talk to me. I don't sing it near as good. There you go. Right there. You never talk to me. Oh, well. Okay. Cabela's here in Greenville is a, it's a great place for the outdoorsman. Lots of things going on there all the time. They do a great service to Department of Natural Resources. These kids we got involved in fishing. And they also have a, they pretty much let anybody go out there and do a seminar, don't they, Larry?
Yes, that's correct. They have quite a few things that they have on their calendar. They're usually pretty full. Almost every day there's something going on. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to say welcome. He's been on the show before to Larry Woodrow Ross, and he's going to have a – you're going to be doing something out there here coming up soon. But before we get to that, do you know how much you look like Woodrow F. Call off Lonesome Dove?
No, I don't. I didn't realize that. Yeah. I don't know whether that's a, I don't know whether that's a compliment or derogatory.
Well, I think if you watch Lonesome Dove like I did, you kind of have a respect for him. He's a man of few words, yeah. Says what he does. But yeah, I was looking at your picture and I said, gosh, he looks like Woodrow Call.
I still see that. I still see that little thing where he and his buddy go into the bar, you know, and he ends up slamming the guy's head down on the bar, you know.
Now, if you'll turn around and look in that picture right there, you see us when we was younger.
Right.
That's a great scene. Great scene. Well, we are in South Carolina, man. We have some really good outdoor writers and all. And, you know, you're one of them. We got Jim Cassada and Pete Rogers and a whole list of them. Why are we so lucky? Is it just because we're Southern and we have a lot of us grew up doing this sort of thing?
Well, I think so. And then, you know, we're fortunate in South Carolina that we have mountains and we have the central part of the state, and then we have the coastal area with the sea coast. So we've got saltwater fishing, freshwater fishing, good deer hunting, turkey hunting, quail hunting in the little part of the state. So I think it's just our outdoor heritage, you know. We're very fortunate.
And it's something if like Jim Mize, if you like trout fishing, you can do trout fishing all. And if it's, you know, bird hunting like Jim Cassidy, you can do that. Turkey hunting. Yeah, you're right. We just got so much of it in here. But
That's right.
You are March 19th, 2 to 5 o'clock, Cabela's at Woodruff Road. Tell us what you got going on out there.
Okay. Well, we're going to have a primitive and survival skills seminar. And we're going to cover a tremendous amount of information. It's going to be a real fast-moving thing. We're going to talk about outdoor tool selection, you know, what you'd need to carry if you're going to be camping in the wilderness area.
Okay.
Fire starting with flint and steel, bow drill, ferro rod, campsite selection, also primitive hunting weapons, how to construct bows, make arrows, Atalal, Cherokee blow gun, flint napping, cordage making from natural fibers, a little bit about useful knots, you know, and also probably mention a little bit about trapping and fur and hide utilization. So it's going to be pretty fast moving. We're going to cover a lot of information in a hurry, and you know, we'll have a little question and answer session at the end, and we all have time. If anybody's got any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer any questions at that time. But it's going to be an interesting session, I think, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, and this is right in your wheelhouse. I mean, this primitive, you know, what we used way back when stuff. This is your wheelhouse, isn't it?
Oh yeah, this is what I love to do. I've done this. I do outdoor seminars for the Saluda River Archery in the summertime. They have an archery camp, and I'll do one day each week during the archery camp. I'll do a session for kids, and always interesting because you never know what kind of questions you're going to run into with kids. They're always inquisitive, and try to do hands on, you know, let them try to start a fire with a bow drill and a lot of interesting things. So it's a pretty cool time, but I'm a primitive archer, you know, I hunt with a longbow, and I've killed several deer with a longbow, killed a lot more with a rifle through the years.
Sure.
Several years ago, I just got interested in doing things a little more primitively. You know, there's not a lot of, challenge in shooting a deer 300 yards away. So,
right.
for me, getting close with a longbow is what it's all about.
You know, you mentioned something there, and I'm not going to tell how old you are, and I'm not going to tell how old I am. But is it a natural progression? You got the five stages of a hunter. Is something like using a longbow or archery or blackbird, is that something that just comes with age for most of us?
Well, I don't know. I've always had an interest in archery, and I've gone through several stages, you know, and I got into the compound bows, and I shot a compound for a while, but, you know, and I got to the point where I wanted to go with something that was lightweight and something a little more natural and primitive. But I remember when I was a kid having a bow and shooting a lot, but I think it's probably true that, you know, as a hunter, you probably go through the stages where you use more technology, and then you get to the point where it's not as critical killing a deer every season or killing four or five or six in a season. In primitive archery, is just more up close and personal.
And one thing everybody told me when I took up bow hunting is that your world is going to get so small when you're in the woods, because it's, you know, 25 yards here, 30 yards there. The biggest thing is,
that's right,
is wind direction. And you've really got to be careful about that wind direction.
Yeah. Well, my wife gets, she questions me because I get up before going hunting and I'll take a shower unscented soap,
yes,
and I use an unscented antiperspirant,
mm-hmm,
and I try to keep my clothes clean and use a non-scented detergent. So, you know, she thinks it's kind of crazy, but I said, you know, a deer's nose is his best defense, you know?
Oh, wow. Tell me about it. I mean,
yeah,
how many times
you amazing.
Been, yeah. When you worried, I was worried about him seeing you, but it's the ones you never see that smell you that, you know, you just never know they're there. And I guarantee there's
right,
a lot more that smell us than we ever see them.
Oh, yeah. I saw an interesting article the other day. There's a young man that's into primitive archery. He writes for one of the same magazines I do, Primitive Archer.
Mm-hmm.
Young man named Ryan Gill. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he posts some articles online and does some things for Primitive Archer and other people. But he's talking about hunting on the ground, not from a blind, but just stalking and hunting from the ground with a primitive bow, a long bow. And that's the ultimate challenge, I think, you know.
Yeah,
I had some good tips. I think that's something I'm probably going to look into. I've traditionally been more of a tree stand
right
hunter, but I think I might try a little bit more of that in this next season.
Well, always fun to try something new. Well,
that's right.
We'll get back to this right before we close out the segment. But you know, I know back at the conference at the National Wild Turkey Federation last October, we were talking, and you've got a bunch of books out there that are available on Amazon Kindle. And,
yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little, because one of them in there is really interesting, but tell us a few of them and I'll come back to the one that I think is really cool.
Okay, well, I've got a couple of novels. There's one that I call The Mexican Connection, which is it's really about a Southern family, and that one of the daughters gets involved and marries a person from Mexico, and it turns into a disaster for her, but her brother and her ex-boyfriend step in and kind of make things happen to improve her situation. I've got a little short book about South Carolina turkey hunting,
mm-hmm,
and then one that's just a collection of outdoor topics. I've got another one that's a historical novel. It's called The Night the Mountain Fell. It's about the landslide that occurred in, I believe it was 59, that created Earthquake Lake in Montana,
mm-hmm,
near Yellowstone,
yep,
National Park.
Yep.
I've actually fished on that lake, but it's interesting. 28 people were killed and only 19 were ever recovered because of the tons and tons of debris that came down and dammed up the Madison River.
Wow.
And, you know, I've got one that's a favorite of mine. It's Longbows, Primitive Skills, and Camping Memories, just a collection of personal adventures.
Uh-huh.
Another one similar to that, Fly Rods, Good Dogs, and Straight Shooting Guns. That's another collection of articles.
Yeah.
That covers a lot of territory.
Oh, it does. It does.
And I did more recently, an Alaskan travel guide. We've been to Alaska three times, just traveling, touring,
mm-hmm,
and doing some fly fishing for salmon.
Yeah.
But, it covers some of the major destination points in Alaska. That's kind of the gist, you know, and I cover survival topics, yeah, and fly fishing and outdoor life and primitive crafts, fly fishing tips for success, and flint napping. I told my wife, I said, I cannot believe the number one seller of all of those subjects is flint napping.
That's the one I was going to get to.
An introduction to flint napping, and it's amazing that, you know, and the power of Kindle is amazing, because I have people in Australia. I sell as many books almost in the UK and Australia as I do in the US, and Denmark and Canada. And I mean, that's the amazing thing about Kindle.
Yeah, it is.
No bounds.
Take about 30 or 45 seconds and tell, real simply, what is flint napping? Because a lot of people don't know.
Okay, flint napping is there's several different approaches. There's Aboriginal flint napping, which uses only natural tools like the primitives did, and then there's more modern flint nappers that use newer tools. But basically, you take a big stone that is it's usually a flint or a chert or something. Obsidian is really, really good.
Okay.
And you take a big hammer stone or a big billet, which is like a small club, and you look at it and you try to picture where it will flake, and then you knock a flake off, and it's what they call a conchoidal fracture. It has a curved surface, and then you have to take that flake, or spall, they're called spalls, S-P-A-L-L. Mm-hmm. You take that spall, and then you shape it with percussion, a smaller billet,
mm-hmm,
and get it down to the general shape, and then you can use pressure flaking. And that can be done with an antler, the way the primitives did it,
mm-hmm,
an antler tine, or the modern tool would be a copper point that's seated in a handle, and you can use pressure and flake and do the final shaping and sharpening. So,
and you're trying to it's an arrowhead.
Interesting process.
Arrowhead's what you're after.
Yeah, arrowhead or spear point or atlatl point, whatever.
Well, March 19th at Cabela's, it's $30. Woodrow, thanks for coming on. Take care of yourself, and let's do this again sometime.
Man, I appreciate it. You take care.
Yes, sir. We'll see. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Y'all hang on through the break. We'll get to the calendar events on the other side, maybe. Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. Little Sammy Hagar, I can't drive 55. Boy, it's amazing things you can remember that you want to remember that you can't remember happened yesterday. Anyway, I'm going to push the calendar off for another segment. We'll do that in the last one. I started, if you tuned in the last show, and I kind of had to come up with a show in a hurry because I decided to run up to Cherokee Lake, Tennessee, and watch the Bassmasters guys get their season off to a start. And then, of course, that Wednesday we had the announcement that the Classic was coming back to South Carolina. And I was at the first FLW tournament in Gunnersville, Alabama, and I wanted to be at the first Bassmasters one and kind of follow these seasons through with our South Carolina anglers. But I knew I wasn't getting through it all because I only had 7 minutes on the show last week to get through this. And I had a couple of reactions, and it was a big draw on the Facebook page and all. And that's a story about digital heroin, how screens turn kids into psychotic junkies. And this is Dr. Nicholas Carderas. It was a story from August 27, 2016. Been kind of holding this thing on for a long time. And I will read the whole thing because, I'll maybe hit the high points. Okay. Susan bought her six-year-old son John an iPad when he was in first grade. I thought, why not let him get a jump on things? She told me that during the therapy session, John's school had begun using the devices with younger and younger grades, and his technology teacher had raved about their educational benefits. So Susan wanted to do what she thought was best for her sandy-haired boy who loved reading and playing baseball. She started letting John play different educational games on his iPad. Eventually, he discovered Minecraft, which the science technology teacher assured her was just like electronic Lego. Remembering how much fun she has had as a child building and playing with the interlocking plastic blocks, Susan let her son Minecraft his afternoons away. At first, Susan was quite pleased. John seemed engaged in creative plays. He explored the cube world of the game. She did notice that the game wasn't quite like the Legos that she remembered. After all, she didn't have to kill animals and find rare minerals to survive and get to the next level with her beloved old game. But John did seem to really like playing, and the school even had a Minecraft club, so how bad could it be? Still, Susan couldn't deny she was seeing changes in John. He started getting more and more focused on his game and losing interest in baseball and reading while refusing to do his chores. Some mornings he'd wake up and tell her that he could see the cube shapes in his dreams. Although that concerned her, she thought her son might just be exhibiting an active imagination. As his behavioral continued to deteriorate, she tried to take the game away from him, but John threw temper tantrums. His outbursts were so severe she gave in, still rationalizing to herself over and over again that it's educational. Then one night she realized that something was seriously wrong. I walked into his room to check on him. He was supposed to be sleeping, and I was just so frightened. She found him sitting up in his bed, staring wide-eyed, his bloodshot eyes looking into the distance as his glowing iPad lay next to him. He seemed to be in a trance. Beside herself with panic, Susan had to shake the boy repeatedly to snap him out of it. Distraught, she could not understand how her once healthy and happy little boy had become so addicted to the game that he wound up in a catatonic stupor. There's a reason that most tech-cautious parents are tech designers and engineers. Steve Jobs was a notoriously low-tech parent. Silicon Valley tech executives and engineers enroll their kids in no-tech Waldorf schools. Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page went to no-tech Montessori schools, as did Amazon creator Jeff Bezos and Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales. Many parents intuitively understand that ubiquitous glowing screens are having a negative effect on kids. We see the aggressive temper tantrums when the devices are taken away and the wandering attention span when children are not perpetually stimulated by their hyper-arousing devices. Worse, we see children who become bored, apathetic, uninteresting, and uninterested when not plugged in. And if you listen to the show any length of time, you heard the story about the kids nowadays are really, humans in general have an attention span of 8 seconds, which is 1 second less than a goldfish. But it's even worse than you think. We now know that those iPads, smartphones, and Xboxes are a form of digital drug. And listen to this now, because this is kind of scary on one sense, but, you know, it's never too late on the other hand. Recent brain imaging research is showing that they affect the brain's frontal cortex, which controls executive functioning, including impulse control, in exactly the same way that cocaine does. Technology is so hyper-arousing that it raises dopamine levels, the feel-good neurotransmitter most involved in the addiction dynamic. The addictive effect is why Dr. Peter Weibrow, director of neuroscience at UCLA, calls screens electronic cocaine, and Chinese researchers call them digital heroin. In fact, Dr. Andrew Doan, the head of addiction research for the Pentagon and the U.S. Navy, who has been researching video game addiction, calls video games and screen technologies digital pharmakia. That's the Greek word for drug. Dave looked over there. He knows Greek, you know. That's right. Your kid's brain on Minecraft looked like a brain on drugs, or any other video game for that matter. No wonder we have a hard time peeling kids from their screens and find out little ones agitated when their screen time is interrupted. In addition, hundreds of clinical studies show that screens increase depression, anxiety, and aggression, and can even lead to psychotic-like features where the video gamer loses touch with reality. In my clinical work with over 1,000 teens over the past 15 years, I have found the old axiom of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure to be especially true when it comes to tech addiction. Once a kid has crossed the line into true tech addiction, treatment can be very difficult. Indeed, I have found it easier to treat heroin and crystal meth addicts than lost in the matrix gamers of Facebook-dependent social media addicts. According to a 2013 policy statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics, 8 to 10-year-olds spend 8 hours a day with various digital media, while teenagers spend 11 hours in front of screens. 1 in 3 kids are using tablets or smartphones before they can talk. Meanwhile, the Handbook of Internet Addiction by Dr. Kimberly Young states that 18% of college-age Internet users in the U.S. suffer from tech addiction. Once a person crosses the line into full-blown addiction, drug, digital, or otherwise, they need to detox before any other kind of therapy can have any chance of being effective. With tech, that means a full digital detox. No computers, no smartphones, no tablets. The extreme digital detox even eliminates television. The prescribed amount of time is 4 to 6 weeks. That's the amount of time that is usually required for a hyper-aroused nervous system to reset itself. But that's no easy task in our current tech-filled society where screens are ubiquitous. A person can live without drugs or alcohol, with tech addiction, digital temptations are everywhere. So how do we keep our children from crossing this line? And this is as far as I got last time, so thank you for listening again. It's not easy. The key is to prevent your 4, 5, or 8-year-old from getting hooked on screens to begin with. That means Lego instead of Minecraft, books instead of iPads, nature and sports instead of TV. If you have to, demand that your child's school not give them a tablet or Chromebook until they are at least 10 years old. Others recommend 12. Have honest discussions with your child about why you are limiting their screen access. Eat dinner with your children without any electronic devices at the table, just as Steve Jobs used to have tech-free dinners with his kids. Don't fall victim to distracted parent syndrome. As we know from social learning theory, monkey see, monkey do. Well, when I speak to my 9-year-old twin boys, I have honest conversations with them about why we don't want them having tablets or playing video games. I explain to them that some kids like playing with their devices so much that they have a hard time stopping or controlling how much they play. I've helped them to understand that if they get caught up with screens and Minecraft like some of their friends have, other parts of their lives may suffer. They might not want to play baseball as much, not read books as often, be less interested in science and nature products, become more disconnected from their real-world friends. Amazingly, they don't need much convincing, as they've seen this firsthand, the changes that some of their friends have undergone as a result of their excessive screen time. Developmental psychologists understand that children's healthy development involves social interaction, creative imaginative play, and engagement with the real natural world. Unfortunately, the immersive and addictive world of screen dampens and stunts these developmental processes. We also know that kids are more prone to addictive escape if they feel alone, alienated, purposeless, and bored. Thus, the solution is often to help kids to connect to meaningful real-life experiences and flesh-and-blood relationships. The engaged child tethered to creative activities and connected to his or her family is less likely to escape into the digital fantasy world. Yet even if a child has the best and most loving support, he or she could fall into the matrix once they engage with hypnotic screens and experience their addicting effect. After all about 1 in 10 people are predisposed towards addictive tendencies. In the end, my client Susan removed John's tablet, but recovery was an uphill battle with many bumps and setbacks along the way. 4 years later, after much support and reinforcement, John is doing much better. He's learned to use a desktop computer in healthier ways, has gotten some sense of balance back in his life. He's playing in a baseball team and has several close friends in the middle school. But his mother is still vigilant and remains a positive and proactive force with his tech usage because, as with any addiction, relapse can sneak up in moments of weakness. Making sure that he has healthy outlets, no computer in his bedroom, and a nightly tech-free dinner at the dinner table are all part of the solution. Now, parents, before you start slapping yourself on the back, and I'm guilty of this, there's another study out here. Parents bitch on media but say they're good role models. Parents spend more than 9 hours a day with TVs, computers, and other screen devices, while also giving themselves high marks as role models for their children's media use. So a little bit of a disconnect there, and I'm guilty of it too. But I often say that technology is a deceptive babysitter. You know, you give a kid a tablet, he disappears, and life is good. But it's not. And it's harder. You can't just kick kids outside. I've said it over and over on this show before. You have to be there with them. Parents, you've got to be the ones to initiate things. You know, take time out of your busy schedule. Get them outdoors. Go with them. You know, how much more as a kid want to get involved with things when you're interested too? Okay. Had to get that out there. Been holding it for a while. Hang on through the break. Be back with more Woods and Water, South Carolina. Welcome back to Woods and Water. Thanks for bearing with me through that one. If you're interested in the article, it's a New York Post article from August the 27th, 2016, called It's Digital Heroin, How Screens Turn Kids into Psychotic Junkies. And, you know, there's so much to do outdoors. We'll get into that. But there's more stories like that one that I've got in a stack that we'll get to. But But there's good stories like how to get kids outdoors and the good effects of being outside in nature and getting dirty and not having a schedule. And you remember what it was like growing up like that. But let's go to the calendar event right quick. And as always, it's brought to you by Visit Anderson, South Carolina and Green Pond Landing and Event Center, which will be hosting the 2018 Bassmaster Classic in March this year. So hopefully it will not be 9 degrees on Friday morning. Yeah, I had heating pads in places I didn't want to think about. If you like the National Wild Turkey Federation, there is practically a dinner going on in every part of the state for the next couple of weeks. Just a few of them on March the 3rd, Gaffney, South Carolina. That's at Broad River Electric Co-op. PD Chapter will have their event on March the 3rd at the Simmet Building in Florence, South Carolina. On the 4th of March, Foothills Chapter is going to have theirs at the Coleman Municipal Recreation Center in Anderson. And again on the 4th, Swamp Fox Local Chapter will have their event on the 4th at the Exchange Building, Ladson Fairgrounds in Ladson, South Carolina. So it's just a few, and you can go to the National Wild Turkey Federation website, look at events, find one in your state, local area, and you'll get the whole thing. I love history. And when you can combine history with, like, hunting, it's even better. Broxton Bridge Plantation, which you've never been there, is a really cool place. It's in a little crossroads called Earhart, South Carolina. The 152nd anniversary of the Battle for Broxton Bridge. It's the 16th annual reenactment, March the 3rd through the 5th, 2017. Living History Day for school children is Friday, March the 3rd. Camps are open Saturday 9 to 5 and Sunday 9 to 4. Battle reenactments are 2 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. And the cool thing about Broxton Bridge is it's a hunting preserve too. So while the kids and mom are getting the history thing, you can talk to the guys about coming down going quail hunting. And it's a really historic place. I think one of the houses there was actually one of the houses that was there during the Revolution. So just a cool place to go. But Broxton Bridge Plantation, Earhart, South Carolina, March 3rd through the 5th. Right here in Greenville, on March the 4th, they're going to have the 2017 South Carolina State Turkey Calling Championships. If you're not a member of the National Wild Turkey Federation and you want to participate, you have to be a member. I think if you go online right now, you can get a Bass Pro Shops gift card with your membership, and they're going to have a booth there you can join the day of. Registration begins at 10 a.m. Contest will begin at 12 p.m. You can register online at the nwtf.org. Your contact is Ryan Groh in Spartanburg. Email is turkeyhuntsc@gmail.com. And they have, you know, state championship, open championship, friction, owl hooting, gobbling, amateur, intermediate, juniors, and poults, which you would expect with the Turkey Federation. So that's going to be March the 4th. On March the 4th, also, if you like fly fishing, the Fly Fishing Film Tour is going to be at Highland Brewing Company in Asheville, South Carolina. The show starts at 7 o'clock. And, you know, locations, they're going to have films from Alaska, Montana, the Kamchatka Peninsula, Kamchatka, Russia, Montana, Florida. It is just a good place to go. They have food trucks there last year when the food was out. I think I had a Cuban sandwich, one of the few food trucks. It was great. And then the film tour. And in the film tour, yeah, it costs you to get in, but they've got lots of giveaways and door prizes and, you know, fly rods and trips and all sorts. And then you get to watch the little film clips, the movies that are submitted each year that are judged to be the best and make the Fly Fishing Film Tour. You get to see that too. So that's put on by Hunter Banks in Asheville. And it's again at the Palmetto, at the Highland Brewing Company in Asheville, starting at 7 o'clock on the 4th. Don't forget the 2017 Palmetto Challenge. And that's the hiking challenge by the Palmetto Conservation Foundation. Runs from March 6th through April the 24th. Registration is open. You know, you and a team, you and another person, you and your dog can get involved in this. And it is just simply wanting you to get out there and get some fresh air, get some exercise. You know, walk, Palmetto Trail, great family thing. You know, get you a team of your family. And what you do is you report in the mileage for the week. And, you know, there's some prizes for the most. And smartphone apps and Fitbits are two methods of tracking the miles. You know, you got the little heart app on your iPhone that you can't get rid of. Well, it tracks your, you know, whether you want it to or not, it tracks your steps. I think the Friday that it went down to Bear Island – and snipe hunted and watched ducks and then went to Seawee. I had 7.2 miles. And let me tell you what, snipe hunting is not you're just walking the woods like quail hunting. It's more like, who knows what it's like. It's tough. Yeah, your bogs, it's like your footing is the most treacherous part of it. And then you're carrying a gun. So get involved. Palmetto Challenge, March 6th through April 24th. March the 11th, first annual Oyster Roast in memory of fisherman Mitchell Gibson. Proceeds from this year are going to go to purchase equipment for DNR and victim services. March the 11th, 6 to 10, McConnell Hall, 3502 Midway Road, Anderson, South Carolina. Adult tickets, 35, youth tickets, 15, age 6 under free. Live music by Clay Page. Clemson fans are going to have a football signed by Dabo Swinney and Danny Ford, and you can bid on that during the silent auction. Upstate SC Crime Victims at gmail.com for more information. And I love this, and we'll end with this one. Can do adventures, because there's no such thing as can't. The Swamp Fox Adventure Race, March 18th, 2017, the Francis Marion National Forest. Oh, get this. The race is 55 to 60 miles. Competitors solo in 2-, 3-, and 4-person teams. The objective of the Palmetto Swamp Fox Adventure Race is to challenge yourself and your team against the elements in the wild, leveled playing field of the Francis Marion Forest. The Palmetto Swamp Fox Adventure Race will be held in the Francis Marion National Forest north of Charleston, South Carolina. Racers will travel across land, swamp, and water, seldom visited by man since the elusive swamp fox himself, Francis Marion. Designed to cover approximately 55 to 60 miles, with a finishing time between 10 and 12 hours, solo racers in teams of 2, 3, and 4 will face some of the most challenging obstacles that nature has in this region. Racers will be required to plot UTM coordinates, orienting, to locate checkpoints while kayaking, paddling, 10 to 12 miles, mountain biking, 20 to 30 miles, and trekking, 15 to 20 miles. The Swamp Fox course is lineal in nature, but all points can be collected in any order within each element. Remember, there's no such thing as can't. Registration's open. It closes March the 7th. So if you're in this and think you can do it, well, more power to you. I was out working for like 2 hours the other day and decided I was in such bad shape that I have almost cut out Cokes and tea. Actually, I have to have a glass of water before I can have a smaller glass of Coke and tea. And it's amazing. I've lost like 5 pounds in a week. And I feel better. I mean, at first it was kind of a, you have a hard time getting going in the day, but it's amazing. So maybe one of these days I'll be in shape for one of those things. Let's see. Couple of programming notes here. Well, let's see. Before I get to programming notes, I saw this. This has nothing to do with the outdoors. Well, it does. Maybe a little bit. Didn't we play You'll Shoot Your Eye Out at Christmas? Okay. I saw this, just had to print off. Lakeland leg lamp sculpture creating controversy. And you look at it and you know exactly what it is. It's like the leg from, you know, A Christmas Story. Anyway, Lakeland, they have an annual sculpture exhibit and one of them's getting mixed reviews. And I can't help laughing because it's just like the movie. And you remember the mom looking at the thing and embarrassed. The leg sculpture called I'll Shoot Your Eye Out is based on the 1983 movie A Christmas Story and certainly is raising a lot of eyebrows. And that's not 1983. The original Christmas Story was in the 50s, I think. Well, you know, for a leg, it's not bad. The lonely high-heeled leg clad in fishnets has Lakeland divided. This is great. It's one of 10 sculptures sprouting up along Lemon Avenue downtown. Art should move you. Well, it moves me down. Another lady said, you know, it's not distasteful. She said, the first thing I thought of was A Christmas Story. So anyway, just to inject a little laughter into your day, the leg sculpture in Lakeland, Florida. You ought to go look it up. News Channel 8 on your side story. Lakeland leg lamp sculpture creating controversy. Anyway, be that it is in May. Programming notes. Yes. If you haven't listened, I broadcast live from Gunnersville, Alabama a few weeks ago and it worked really well. So we're going to try this again next Saturday morning. Well, next Saturday, I'll be at the National Wild Turkey Federation, the Palmetto Shooting Complex. They're going to have 625 kids shooting in a sporting clays open down there, probably 2,500 to 3,000 people all together. But I'm going to be down there. We're going to talk to people at the shooting complex. You know, that's open for public. You and I can go there and shoot. We're going to talk to somebody there at the shooting complex about it. We're probably going to talk to somebody from National Wild Turkey Federation. I would love to pull in a coach or a shooter and have firsthand let you hear what the Scholastic Sporting Clays program we have here in South Carolina is all about, because there are tons of kids out there that would love to learn how to shoot a shotgun. And that's all part of getting outdoors. And even if you never hunt, and even if you never go any further than shooting some clay targets and some clay rabbits and some middies and minis and batus and whatever else, you know, it's getting out there, something you can do as a family. It's no different than playing on a basketball team. You're traveling to competitions and all, except there's just not as many of them, but just a great thing. So the 4th will be at the Palmetto Shooting Complex down in Edgefield, South Carolina. On the 11th, I'll be at Low Country Fly Shop in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. The 11th is, well, we're having a barbecue the night before with Saluda River Trout Unlimited. Then the night of the 11th is the Fly Fishing Film Tour in Charleston. Always a great event. I always like to make it down to that one. So we'll be there. We'll probably touch base with Lee Janik. If you don't know, we have a fly rod manufacturer in South Carolina now. It's Clutch Fly Rods. We'll talk to Saluda River TU. Talk to somebody from the Fly Fishing Film Tour and get an inside look at this year's tour. And then maybe by the 18th, I'll be back in the studio. It's kind of cool going out and being there. It's different when you have a guest call in or here in the station, but it's another thing altogether to be on site and bring it to you live. So looking forward to it. And that's another show. Hey, look, the weather is great. It's going to get a little cold. Doesn't matter. Make plans to get out there now. If you don't make them, you won't follow through with them. And as always, take the back roads when you can. Don't forget that camera. I'll see you here next week in Edgefield, South Carolina, on Moore Woods and Water, South Carolina.